The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ahoy, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. That is my last nautical reference, so don't worry about it. I'm not gonna do that to you. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here, and I'm very excited to be here to introduce David Graham. David Graham is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI, an account of the chilling true life story of one of the most sinister conspiracies in U.S. history. A finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the Edgar Allan Poe Award, it has been adapted into an upcoming film directed by Martin Scorsese, starring everybody from Leonardo DiCaprio to Jason Isbell. His other bestsellers include The Lost City of Z, the nonfiction tale of the deadly search for a fabled Amazonian civilization, and The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, named by Men's Journal as one of the best true crime books ever written. An award-winning staff writer at The New Yorker, David has previously contributed to The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and The New Republic, among other periodicals. He joins us tonight with his latest nonfiction work, The Wager, a tale of shipwreck, mutiny, and murder. In it, he details the wildly differing narratives offered by two groups of 18th century British naval castaways. A New York Times review praises David as a consummate narrative architect, and that the kind of nonfiction narratives the New York writer has become known for share something essential with a sturdy ship, a vessel freighted with historical controversy, tangled facts, and monomaniacal characters needs to be structurally sound, containing and conveying its messy cargo. It should be resilient, yet nimble enough to withstand the unpredictable waters of readers' attentions and expectations. Only an impeccable design will keep everything moving. A great analogy, but I got an early copy of this, which is a perk to this job. And if ever there was a first line on the back of a book to get you reading, on January 28, 1742, a ramshackle vessel of patched together wood and cloth washed up on the coast of Brazil. I had to read more, and I'm diving into it and enjoying it, as I'm sure you will. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Graham to the Free Library.
Hello, all. It's good to be in Philadelphia. Thank you all for coming. Research can lead you to places you never expect. For example, one day several years ago, I found myself on a small wood-heated boat. It was a motorboat, and we were off the Chilean coast of Patagonia, entering what is known as the Gulf of Sorrows, or as some prefer to call it, the Gulf of Pain. It was freezing winter, and we were caught in a storm with towering waves that dwarfed the boat. In front of the boat, all I could see was a mountain of water, and behind us, all I could see was another mountain. The boat had a captain and two crew members and was being tossed about so violently that I had to sit on the deck in the cabin and did not dare stand, or I might be thrown in the air and break a limb. And just so you know, I am not exaggerating, here you can glimpse our little boat as we are being tossed about. And as you can probably tell, I'm not much of an adventurer, and I had taken every possible remedy to stave off seasickness. I had one of those patches behind my ear, and I was dosed on so much Dramamine I was half drunk. I felt increasingly nauseous as objects, a jacket, a bilge pump, flew past me. We had not seen another boat or a soul for more than a week, and I kept glancing out the porthole, hoping to glimpse a sign of that desolate place that had consumed my imagination, Wager Island. On that deserted island had unfolded one of the most extraordinary and gripping sagas I had ever heard of, one that had influenced philosophers like Rousseau and Voltaire, Charles Darwin, the scientist, and two of the great novelists of the sea, Herman Melville and later Patrick O'Brien. Yet as the boat rolled further and further over the sea, swallowing the deck, I began to wonder what you're probably wondering now. What the hell was I doing in the Gulf of Pain? The story begins, believe it or not, all the way back in 1742. It was then that a small battered boat had washed ashore off the coast of Brazil. 30 men were crammed on board, their bodies almost wasted to the bone. Most of them were so weak they could not even stand. But a figure in charge rose with an extraordinary exertion of will and announced that they were the survivors of His Majesty's ship, the Wager, and that they had been shipwrecked on a desolate island for months. And after building this flimsy craft, they had traveled over months, nearly 3,000 miles. It was one of the longest castaway voyages ever recorded. They were hailed for their ingenuity and for their bravery. But then, 6 months later, another little boat washed ashore, this time on the other side of South America, on the Patagonia coast of Chile. This was not a ship, it was just a boat. It was even more battered and tinier, and on board were only three men, one of whom was so delirious he could not even recollect his name. But when they recovered, they told a very, very different story, and they leveled a shocking allegation. Those others, they said, who had preceded them and gone to Brazil were not actually heroes. They were mutineers. And in the controversy that followed with charges and countercharges from both sides, it became clear that while they were stranded on this desolate island, they had slowly descended into a real-life Lord of the Flies, a Hobbesian state with warring factions and abandonments and murders. Back in England, the principal figures from each group, along with their allies, were summoned to face a court-martial for their alleged crimes on the island. And several of the accused released their wildly conflicting counts, which sparked another kind of war, a war over the truth. Joan Didion famously said that we all tell ourselves stories in order to live. But in their case, it was quite literally true, because if they did not tell a convincing tale, they could be hanged. The men, and there were boys among them too, had once hoped to return from the expedition bathed in glory. After an imperial war had broken out between Great Britain and its rival Spain in 1739, the Wager's officers and crew had received orders to embark with a squadron on a secret mission to try to capture a Spanish galleon filled with so much treasure, it was known as the prize of all the oceans. Believe it or not, that was part of their mission. It had a whiff of piracy, and in fact, the seamen were offered a tantalizing prospect, a share of the plunder. But first, the Wager and the four other warships in the squadron, including the Centurion, which was under the command of the expedition's leader, Commodore George Anson, had to get out of the dockyards in England, a task that was proving insurmountable. These warships were the engineering marvels of their time. They were devised to be the murderous instruments for battle and war filled with cannons, and they were also designed to be the homes of hundreds of sailors living together in close quarters for years at a time as a family. The Wager, and here you can see a very precise model, was 123 feet long. It had rows of cannon on each side and three towering masts. It could fly more than a dozen sails. And here you can get a glimpse of what life was like on these ships and the gun deck. And they actually had to sleep and eat right alongside the cannons. There was usually only about a foot separating the seamen when they would sleep in their hammocks, so that the ship rocked, their knees and elbows would jostle. Yet as sophisticated as these instruments were, with their lethal instruments and propelled by sail, they were also very vulnerable because they were made of perishable materials, mostly wood, which was very susceptible to storm and sea. One of the more astonishing facts I came across in that construction of these wooden worlds, as many as 4,000 trees might go into the construction of just one vessel. The squadron was laid up at what was known as Rotten Row, waiting to be repaired for the voyage. Moreover, given that the expedition could last as long as 3 years, because they were going to sail all the way across the Atlantic, around Cape Horn, into the Pacific, try to intercept the galleon off the coast of the Philippines, and then, if successful, continue all the way around the world. And given the length of the voyage, each ship also had to be loaded with countless tons of provisions. A single ship in the squadron would require some 40 miles of rope, more than 15,000 square feet of sail, and a farm's worth of livestock, chicken, pigs, and cattle, which were always very uncooperative in trying to get on board. They didn't really like to go to sea. And more than that, and most importantly, the squadron would require nearly 2,000 skilled officers and crew to operate all the ships. The Wager, which was the smallest of the warships, and it was kind of considered a little bit the ugly duckling of the group because it was not born for battle. It had been a merchant ship that was remade into a warship before the war. The Wager would require some 250 men, which was nearly double the number it usually carried. But the Navy had exhausted its supply of volunteers, and it did not have a policy of conscription. And so the Admiralty unleashed the press gangs who would roam into cities and towns and ports. And if they saw anyone with the telltale signs of a mariner, you know, a rounded hat or a checkered shirt, or even a little tar, they would check your fingertips. If you had a little tar on it, tar was used on ships a lot to keep things water resistant. They would recognize you as a mariner, and they would, in effect, kidnap you, put you on a small little boat like a floating jail, and take you out to these ships unwillingly. Even after they had done this, the Admiralty and the squadron were still short of men, and so they took the extraordinary and extreme measure of rounding up scores of soldiers from a retirement home, many of whom were in their 60s and 70s, who were missing an assortment of limbs. Some of them were so ill they had to be lifted on stretchers onto these ships. One of the things that made life on these ships so fascinating is that they were like an experiment to test the bounds of human sociability. Strangers from all walks of life would be thrown together, some as young as 6 and others on the Wager the cook was in his 80s. There would be aristocrats and dandies. There would be city paupers and free black seamen and professional craftsmen, carpenters and barrel makers. This is a great description from one sailor. He observed, "A man of war," that's what these warships were referred to then, "may justly be styled as an epitome of the world in which there is a sample of every character, some good men as well as bad. Among the latter," he noted, "were highwaymen, burglars, pickpockets, debauchees, adulterers, gamesters, lampooners, bastard-getters, impostors, panders, parasites, ruffians, hypocrites, and my favorite, thread-worn bow-jack-a-dandies." The British Navy was known for its ability to coalesce these fractious individuals into what Horatio Nelson, the Vice Admiral, had called a band of brothers. But on the Wager, the challenge was enormous, given the extraordinary number of pressed and sickly men. By September of 1740, nearly a year had gone by since the start of the war, and still the Wager and the other ships were marooned on the dockyards. But finally, on September 8th, the squadron, along with 2 small cargo vessels, which planned to accompany the expedition partway, set off on this perilous voyage. And this is amazing. This is a sketch actually done by somebody who was on board one of the ships. He was a lieutenant. You can see the Wager there marked. And the Centurion is the bigger ship, and you can kind of see it. It's kind of facing the other way with the extra flag, the Commodore signal flag at the top. And the book is structured in an unusual way. It focuses on the competing counts of three men on board the Wager. Now, we all impose some coherence, some meaning on the chaotic events of our existence. We rummage through the raw images of our memories, selecting, burnishing, erasing. And I organized the book this way to show how each of these men tried to shape his story, hoping to emerge as its hero. One perspective is that of David Sheep, who was recently promoted to captain of the Wager. He was a burly Scotsman in his 40s with an explosive temperament and obsessive dreams of glory. He had been plagued by debts and chased by creditors back in Scotland, but he always found refuge on a regimented wooden world of a ship. And he had finally obtained what he had always longed for, a chance to captain his own warship on this voyage and to possibly capture a lucrative prize. The second perspective is that of the Wager's gunner, John Bulkley. And we don't know what he looked like because he came from the lower to middle classes. He could never afford to have had a portrait made of him. But we know his thoughts intimately because he was a compulsive diarist. He was considered the most skilled seaman on the Wager and an instinctive leader. Yet because he did not come from the aristocracy, he knew that he would never become a captain of a warship in those times of class structure. And the third perspective and third point of view comes from John Byron, who was a midshipman on the Wager. He was only 16 years old when the voyage began. He came from the nobility and later became the grandfather of the poet Lord Byron, whose work, especially Don June, was profoundly influenced by what the poet referred to as my great-granddad's narrative. Unlike many of the men on the voyage, he had volunteered for the perilous mission, enraptured by tales of sea adventures. And this is a story not only about how people tell stories, but also how they themselves are shaped by the stories they hear. As a midshipman, he was in training to become an officer. And in many ways, he is our eyes and ears onto this bewildering floating civilization. He must master a new coded language on the ship. It was only working on this book that I realized how many of the idioms we use today derived from the age of sail. For example, scuttlebutt. That was a barrel in the middle of a ship which was filled with water where the seamen would gather for their water rations. And what would they do around the barrel? They would gossip. Pipe down was the bosun's whistle to be quiet at night. Piping hot was his whistle that mealtime had come. Under the weather. This one really surprised me. Under the weather, you know, I always thought it was just a kind of a metaphor for sickness. Like, you kind of feel like under the weather. Well, it turns out that when you're in a ship and you were sick, you didn't actually have to serve on watch. And so you were not on deck. You were actually stayed below in the sick quarters. So you were quite literally under the weather. And perhaps my favorite of all these expressions was to turn a blind eye. And that came a little bit later in the century when Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson wanted to ignore his superior's officer's signal flag in the distance to retreat in a battle. And so what did he do? He took his little telescope and he put it up. He had a blind eye. He put it up to his blind eye. So that's why we say to turn a blind eye today. I could go on. I could have written a whole book about these expressions. One day, early in the voyage, Byron heard that petrifying order eventually given to every midshipman. Aloft you go. He had to climb up the main mast, which rose some 100 feet into the sky in order to work the sails. A plunge from such a height would undoubtedly kill them. They had to climb along the ropes that held up the mast, and sometimes their backs were nearly parallel to the deck as they climbed. He could see the other great ships in the squadron, and beyond them the sea, a blank expanse on which he was ready to write his own romantic story. But soon everything on the voyage began to go wrong. As the squadron crossed the Atlantic, it found itself being chased by a more powerful Spanish armada. This is a sea battle that later took place You can see the centurion in battle. They would fight really close side by side, firing their cannonballs. And the real danger wasn't so much the cannonballs or the muskets. It was actually the splinters from the cannonballs, which would break into these wooden worlds and explode, showering splinters that could be a foot or 2 feet or 3 feet, and would spear people and kill them. Then they faced an even greater threat, the seas around Cape Horn at the southernmost tip of the Americas. Because these far southern seas are the only waters that flow uninterrupted around the globe, the waves build over as much as 13,000 miles without being impeded by land, accumulating power. The so-called Cape Horn rollers, these waves, can dwarf a 90-foot mast. The currents are also the strongest on Earth in this funnel. And then there are the winds, which can reach 200 miles per hour. Herman Melville, who later went around the Horn, compared it to a descent into hell in Dante's Inferno. And as the men in the squadron tried to round the Horn, they were battered by storms day and night. The boy John Byron would stare in awe at the waves that broke over the wager, banding it about as if it were no more than a pitiful rowboat. Water seeped through virtually every seam of the hull, so they were constantly bailing, flooding the decks and the lower decks. The temperature kept dropping until the rains hardened into sleet and snow. Cables became encrusted, and some of the men succumbed to frostbite. There's a great saying, which is, below 40 degrees latitude, there is no law. Below 50 degrees, there is no God. And they were now in what was known as the Furious 50s. Captain Cheap and the other commanders knew that they would need everybody on board if they were to have a chance to persevere. But it was at that moment when many of the crew could no longer rise from their hammocks, suffering from a mysterious illness. Their eyes bulged and their teeth fell out, and so did their hair. Even the cartilage that glued together their bodies seemed to be loosening. Incredibly, one man on one of the ships had fallen in a battle 50 years earlier, and he had broken his bone. It had obviously long since healed over 5 decades. And suddenly, with this disease, that same bone mysteriously cracks and fractures again in the very same place. And some of the men descended into lunacy, or as one wrote, the disease got into their brains and they ran raving mad. They were suffering from the great enigma of the age of sail, scurvy. The disease killed more mariners than all other threats, including gun battles, tempests, and other diseases combined. No one then knew that it was brought on by a deficiency of vitamin C and that the cure was so simple, adding fruit and vegetables to their diet. Before they had rounded Cape Horn at the very tip of the Americas, they had stopped in Brazil, and there was an abundance of limes and could have saved their lives. And British seamen, once they understood where scurvy came from, would later carry limes on board their ships. And so that's why British seamen are referred to as limeys. This was one of the worst maritime outbreaks of scurvy ever recorded. Hundreds and hundreds of men in the squadron perished, their bodies tossed overboard unceremoniously. As the poet Lord Byron would later put it, without a grave, unknelled, uncoffined, and unknown. Cheap and the other captains were increasingly running out of hands to operate their vessels. Some ships did not even have enough people to raise a sail. The men tried to keep their vessels close together, knowing that if the ship separated, there would be no one to rescue them in the event of a wreck. And the men would fire their guns. You know, there was no, you didn't have your iPhone or your walkie-talkie or, any ways to communicate. So how do they communicate? They could try to shout to each other, but in that storm, you would never hear them, and they couldn't get that close to each other. So they would fire their guns to try to signal to their patient, or they would flash lanterns constantly. But in the storm, the booming guns were drowned out, and all the ships eventually scattered, and the wager was suddenly left alone and to its own destiny. And Cheap was determined to prove himself. as this heroic captain he had always imagined himself. And he was determined to reach an area off Chile where Anson had advised they should rendezvous if they were ever separated. He managed to guide the ship around the Horn, joining that elite club. But all the sailors at that time, Cheap and his men had to navigate partially blind. They could determine their latitude easily by reading the stars, but they had no way of knowing their longitude because they would have needed a reliable clock, which had yet to be invented. And so they had to rely on dead reckoning, which, to simplify, essentially amounted to informed guesswork and a leap of faith. And there's a reason why it's called dead reckoning. And Captain Cheap and his navigators' estimation of their longitude as they were coming along the coast of Chile turned out not only to be wrong, but wrong by hundreds and hundreds of miles. And suddenly they crashed into a submerged rock in the Gulf of Penas, the Gulf of Sorrows, or the Gulf of Pain. And the rudder shattered. A 2-ton anchor rattled and fell and plunged through the floor of the ship, leaving a gaping hole. Then another giant wave washed the wager off the rocks, and it went careening through this minefield of rocks, sailing without a rudder and with the water just pouring into it. And you have to understand, this was their fortress, this was their home, and many seamen in that day could not swim. And then the wager finally hits some more rocks, and finally it just begins to rip apart. The planks shatter, the decks cave in and collapse. Water surges upward through the bottom of the ship. Rats begin to scurry upward. Those who were suffering from scurvy, who were too sick to get out of their hammocks, drowned. But several of the survivors climb to the ruins of the wreck because the ship had not yet completely sank. It had kind of become wedged almost miraculously between a pillar of rocks. And there it waited to sink soon, but not yet. And so the survivors climbed up onto these ruins, Byron among them, and he looked out into the distance and through the mist. What could he see? He could see an island. And these were paintings done in the 1740s depicting trying to render what it was like for the wager in the distress and then in the wreck. This is a photograph I took of the island. And of course, after all that, after all they've been through, coming around Cape Horn, the scurvy, the shipwreck, they get to the island, and that's where the real hell would begin. About 150 of them make it ashore in one of these little small transport boats, like a rowboat that could fly a sail, which they ferry them back and forth. And they think, well, maybe this will be our salvation. Yet the island turns out to be barren and windswept and desolate, freezing cold, the temperature usually hovering about 30 degrees, and it's constantly raining or sleeting. And worst of all, they could find virtually no food. Some bits of celery they found and little bits of seaweed. But there were no animals other than some birds that would fly off around the island. One British officer later described the island as a place where the soul of man dies in him. And this, again, is an engraving from the 1740s that depicting what it was like for the castaways when they get onto Wager Island. And this is another engraving. Here is some of the kind of seaweed they were forced to eat and bits of celery, which did have one unexpected and mysterious effect on the seamen. What did it do? It cured their scurvy because it had some vitamin C in it, but they didn't know that. And this is where they really, all their wits had to be tested because they were suffering from hypothermia and they were beginning to starve. And now because most of you have not yet read the book, I won't spoil the unfathomable saga that ensued. But what is so interesting is that that island became in many ways this perfect laboratory to test the human condition under extreme circumstances. Inevitably, it would reveal the men's nature, the good and the bad. Captain Cheap initially tried to establish an imperial outpost on the island, governed by the same regimented rules that had existed on the ship and the same rigid hierarchy. He believed that was the only way they would survive. But the men gradually descended into warring factions and murderous anarchy. And what is remarkable is that even in that state of nature, as one of them describes it, the castaways would hold these fierce debates, these philosophical debates about the nature of leadership and loyalty, about duty and patriotism. What did it take to make a leader? What rules should they now be governed by? Should Captain Cheap remain their commander because he was their commander at sea? Or was it possible that in this democracy of suffering, Bulkley, the gunner, that instinctive leader, though he did not come from the aristocracy, might be able to rise and become a commander in his own right? At one point, they're visited by a group of native Patagonians in canoes. They were a party of Kawaskar. And along with several other indigenous groups in the region, they had settled in Patagonia thousands of years earlier. They generally traveled in small familial groups and spent much of their time in canoes and survived almost exclusively off marine resources. They have been called the nomads of the sea. And over the centuries, they had adapted to the harsh environment. In fact, NASA would later send investigators to study them to see how they had adapted when they were planning before they did their mission to the moon. They kept warm by always keeping a fire going. And even in their canoes, they always kept fires going, even in their canoes. And they knew where to find hidden shoals of fish and reefs up along the thousands of miles of coastline along Patagonia. And they could find mussels and fish and sea urchins. And they generously brought food. They went out and they saw that the castaways were starving. And so they went out and they brought them food. But this is a story also about imperialism. And it's a story about racism. And many of the castaways were raised in that system, and held those prejudices. In their accounts, they would refer to these natives as savages. And I put that in quotes. And so some of them ended up mistreating the Kawaskar. And as the Kawaskar are kind of watching these hairy castaways spiraling into chaos and violence, they eventually, we don't have a written record, we just have the account from the castaways, but they eventually just said, we're out of here. We've seen enough of you people. We've got enough of this. And one morning, they just disappear in their canoes. Early wee hours of the morning, they just vanish. And so this is that rare instance where imperialists, were not only causing destruction of other cultures, but they also helped cause the destruction of themselves because they suddenly lost their lifeline. And after the Kawaskar left, many of them descended further into a Hobbesian state of depravity. Again, with shootings and killings, and some of the men even succumb to cannibalism. And these are older engravings showing some of the violence that occurred on the island. Now, incredibly, some of these castaways make it back to England, and after months and months, and those voyages they took, and when you read the book, you will see, were extraordinary sagas unto themselves. Some traveled in one little castaway boat, patched together, some 3,000 miles. Their bodies were packed together so tightly they could not even move, couldn't stand. They had virtually no provisions. They had no charts, and they had to navigate through squalls and storms through the Strait of Magellan and up the coast all the way to Brazil. But then back in England, they were, as they had feared, hauled before a court-martial, a military tribunal, where they faced the prospect of being hanged for their alleged crimes. And after they had waged a war against all these elements, they now began to wage a war over the truth. And when I was researching this story, I would go to these archives and pull these old crumbling journals and logbooks and muster books, which somehow miraculously survived this expedition. And I would be reading about disinformation and misinformation, allegations of fake journals. Then I would come home, and what would I do? I'd flip on the TV, or I'd read the paper, and what would I hear? Alternative facts, fake news, lies, disinformation. I'd search Twitter and be bewildered by what is true and what is not. And then I would go back to the archives and read about these kind of fights over history and who would get to tell it. And I would come back and see battles over what books would be told. So the story really felt to me like a parable for our own turbulent times, because there really was a massive struggle in this case over which, this is a battle of stories, and there was a battle over which version of history would prevail and efforts to cover up the scandalous truth. Because the British Empire is kind of listening to these stories going, do we like any of these stories? You know, these deeds are undercutting the claim that the British Empire had used to justify its ruthless expansion, which was that its civilization was somehow superior to all others. And yet here on this island, there are officers and crew, these vanguard of the British Empire, these so-called apostles of Western civilization, had behaved more like brutes than like gentlemen. And so the empire is also fighting for a story, its own version of history, its own mythic tale of the sea. And one of the central themes of the book, which really grew in part out of my experience researching my previous book, Killers of the Flower Moon, which was about this awful racial injustice and these serial monstrous crimes against members of the Osage Nation to steal their oil money. That was a chapter of history from, you know, the early 20th century, and yet for most of us outside the Osage Nation, we were never taught it. We did not know it. It had been excised from our consciousness. And so I was very interested in why certain parts of history are taught and certain parts are erased. And this was such a perfect illustration of that. And I realized that just as people tell stories to serve their interests, so do nations. Now, when I first began researching the Wager of Fear, I ventured only to the places most suited for my very strong physical attributes, which was in archives. I like a good archive. And as I said, there was this surprising trove of firsthand documents. Here you can see, it's hard to read, but you can see a logbook that was kept on one of the ships. This logbook went around the world. It somehow managed to survive, the tidal waves and water flooding in and naval battles. But you can read it. When you take it out of the box, it's crumbling. The cover is crumbling. All this dust breathes out like a cloud. But you can really meticulously begin to reconstruct this expedition almost day to day. And it took me a little bit of a while to be able to read these documents, some of them, and to understand them, to become fluent in some of their symbols. One of the records that you could get from these ships were muster books. And when I first pulled a muster book, it just looked like gibberish to me. Essentially, a muster book was just it's like a record of enlistment. So whenever you arrived on a ship, your name was written down on the ship, your rank, you were an ordinary sailman, an able seaman, were you an officer, or whatnot. But then there's a little column with these abbreviations. And at first I was like, what do they mean? I had no idea. And I kept noticing when I would go down the muster books, the letters DD, DD, DD. And I was like, God, what is DD? And then I would turn another page, DD, DD. And eventually I learned that DD meant discharged dead. And what it meant is that all these names that had been enlisted early on in the roll calls had died during the expedition. So this kind of archaic seeming anodyne document really contained the evidence of the true toll this expedition had taken. More than 1,300 of them died in an expedition of nearly 2,000 people. But After a couple of years of combing through these archives, something happens which often happens to a researcher, which you begin to be gnawed by doubts about what you don't know. What could you learn more? And I began to fear I could never fully understand what it was like for these castaways on the island. What had really happened? You know, what had they experienced? And so it was then that I decided to do something rather foolish, was to organize my own little expedition to Wager Island. I found a Chilean captain with the help of somebody who had a boat who agreed to take me there. And we were going to depart from Chiloé Island, which is about 350 miles north of Wager Island off the coast of Chile. They had sent me a photograph of the boat. And, you know, it looked really big in the photograph. But when I got there and I arrived in Chiloé Island, it was pretty small. And it was very top heavy. This was my cabin. And it was so rough at first. We were supposed to depart immediately. But the Coast Guard closed the port. I always thought if you were a seaman, if you really wanted to kill yourself, you could. But in Chile, they're responsible. So if the weather is just, if there's like basically a gale, hurricane-like storm, they just shut the port. So we couldn't leave. So one day passed. We were on the boat just waiting in port. 2 days, 3 days. My captain just slipped in. We just need a window, just a small window to get across this gulf. Eventually, at dawn one morning, we were allowed out. We slipped through this gulf. And initially, we traveled in the channels of Patagonia. And these channels, I don't know if anyone here has been to Patagonia, they're actually calm because they're very sheltered and they're very beautiful. They're covered by mist. For many, many days, we would never see another boat or a soul. I mean, this is a very remote area. Here you can see us again going through the channels. And on our boat, we would have to stop along the shore, along these islands, and pull up along them. There you can see our captain cutting down wood to fuel our wood stove so we could stay warm. It was winter, it was about 30 degrees out, 40 degrees out. And we also had to take the water from the glacial streams in order to get water for the boat. So they would run these hoses up into these mountainous islands and then capture the water so we would have drinking water. And after several days of my confidence growing about how easy this journey was gonna be and how sweet and pleasant it was gonna be, the captain said to me, well, you know, now if we're going to get to Wager Island, we actually have to go out into the open ocean. We can no longer stay in these channels. And it was then that I got my taste of these, you know, gorgeous seas. And, you know, because this boat was so top heavy, you really were just tossed about. To pass the time as I was sitting on the floor, I would listen to a Moby Dick, which I know. Just call me a brainiac. Not the most soothing thing to have done in retrospect. But our captain was very skilled, and eventually he led us into the Gulf of Pain. And at one point, we were going by these islands. And he points them. They were on the map. And he said, oh, that's Waller Island, and that's Smith Island, and that's Hobbs Island. I said, God, those islands are such curiously English-sounding names. And I had brought with me some of the journals from the castaways, and I went to look at them. And as I was looking at them, I realized that I found the names. And it turned out that these were four castaways who had been trying to escape with another group of castaways. And they had two small boats. And when one of the boats sank, there was no longer enough space for all of them on the other boat. And so these four castaways were abandoned on the island to die. And the last words they said were, God bless the king. And these islands are their epitaph. They are named after them, but like so much of this once sensational history and story, most contemporary seamen, including my captain, had no idea why they were called that. He just knew that they were on the map as those islands. And we also went by an island called Byron Island and a canal called Cheap Canal. It's kind of littered. History informs the present even when we don't realize it. And eventually we got to Wager Island. And I left, we left in a little Zodiac. You can see how mountain it is, a really ugly picture of me, but it does give you a sense, and the reason I include it is because I was so bundled up, because again, it's cold, and I had all these layers on me, as we all did in our group, wool hat and long johns, and turtlenecks and gloves and boots, and yet I was still cold. And it began to help me understand how cold the castaways must have been with their scraps of clothing, many of which gradually disintegrated. They were barefoot. And it was only then, actually, that I began to realize, because in their accounts they just say we're freezing, that I realized, oh my goodness, they must have all been suffering from hypothermia, a term they wouldn't have used. And we eventually got to the island. It still remains a place of wild desolation. It's still barren. It's windswept. The trees are all bent at 45-degree angles from the wind. They look like they're lying on top of each other, or I always thought they looked a little bit like hurtling sprinters. And the castaways had described how hard it was to walk on the island in their journals and accounts. And I was like, how hard could it be to walk on an island? Well, here you can see a little bit of the beach. There are little, like this is near their encampment, there was a little beach, and you could walk up and down that beach. But if you tried to walk across the island, it's almost impossible. It's so mountainous, and the foliage is so dense and thick and boggy that it's like pushing through hedges. You know, I tried to walk like, 50 yards, and you're just exhausted. So again, got a better understanding of that. And like them, I could find virtually no food. There were no animals on the island, again, other than the birds. We did find some of the celery, which they had eaten that helped save their lives. And it was only after this trip that I could understand that line by the British officer when he said that, this is a place where the soul of man dies in him. I was like, oh yeah, my soul would die in me here. So I don't write about my expedition in the book. I'm sharing it with you. But it informed and breathed life into so much of what I did write and describe. And there came a point when we were exploring the encampment area near where they had built this little settlement with their huts and lean-tos. The huts and lean-tos are no longer there. And one of the members of our group yelled out, look. And there was a little icy stream. And in the icy stream, we could see these timbers, which you can see here. They were about 5 yards long. They were bound together by, not nails like we would have nails, but wooden pegs. And they are from an 18th century ship, believed to be His Majesty's ship, the Wager. And we knew what they were because they had been discovered several years later by a scientific expedition, a joint British and Chilean expedition, who had found them. And that's all there is. Nothing else remains of this furious struggle that once took place there, or of the ravaging dreams of empire. And after I spent years, and I would spend more years after, researching all these warring stories, all this sound and fury, I just stood there looking out at these timber and then out at the ocean, and the only sound I could hear was the eternal hush of the sea. So I'd be happy now to answer any of your questions about this or any other books or whatever you're interested in.
Hi, I was going to ask you said 1,300 of the people died out of 2,000.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's not typical maybe of this time period on shipping?
Yes, that was it's a really good question. I should have pointed out that was a shocking death rate even for a voyage of this nature. This really was, in many ways, a disastrous voyage. But when you read the book, there are some unexpected twists as well.
Hi. Your books, I mean, while they do sort of have themes like that you mentioned earlier when you talked about the Killer of the August Moon, but there's so many topics. Is there a process or a method to how you decide what book you're going to work on next?
Yeah. I am a quintessential generalist. So I'll spend years on these subjects. This one, the Killers of the Flower Moon took half a decade. This one took half a decade because I try to write them in a very kind of visual manner. So to do that, but to be factual, takes a lot of time. And when I'm usually finished with a project, I don't really want to return to that subject specifically. And so my curiosity leads me elsewhere. And I do have a kind of boundless enthusiasm and curiosity about the world. And so the stories are, you know, very unlike each other. I mean, I've written about, you know, the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar was found mysteriously garroted in his apartment, and all these Sherlockians and Conan Doyle experts took up the case as if it were one of, you know, the greatest that Sherlock Holmes had invented. I've written about, you know, scientists hunting for a giant squid, trying to become the first scientist to capture giant squid. Lost City of Z, about an explorer who disappeared in the Amazon searching for a lost city. And so, yeah, they really are all different. There is an analytical process that you go through that you kind of check off to some extent. You see something that has just kind of grabbed you or is intriguing. It can begin in very unexpected ways. I once just, not a book, but did a story for The New Yorker that grew out of a brief, a little newspaper short that I was reading. And it was just about a paragraph long, you know, that used to run in metropolitan papers when they were flourishing and you could read them in any state. And it described how members of a ruthless prison gang had been rounded up and arrested while in prison, including solitary confinement. And I just kept pausing over those words, arrested while in prison. And it made me wonder, well, how do you run a crime organization in prison? Like, what is your, and how do you even communicate when you're in solitary? How do you even get messages out? What is your currency that you use? How do you implement? So that ended up led me to do a story about the Aryan Brotherhood and this kind of murderous prison gang. So sometimes it can begin with just these combination of words. But the challenge of a book is much bigger, because for a magazine piece, you know, I could spend 2 to 3 months on it, and then you're done and you move on. And it only has to have really one dimension in a way. It's more linear in where it goes. And with a book, you need to find a story that keeps opening up. Every time you reach the end, there's another door or trap door to go through. And it can begin often with just, you know, the Lost City of Z began with a footnote. When I was doing the Conan Doyle story about the Sherlock Holmes scholar. So I was reading everything about Conan Doyle, and I found a footnote that said that this character, this explorer, Percy Harrison Fawcett, had been an inspiration for the novel The Lost World. And I said, who is that person? And so that set me off investigating this person. Again, once had been huge news, then vanished. So you need to find something that kind of has what I call the grip, a story that's going to hold you and grip you in its particulars. It's just, for whatever reasons, the story itself has kind of twists and turns and movement, and it has subjects that are deeply fascinating, whether they're good or bad. But then you need another question you have to go through, and this is the analytical process. Do the materials exist to actually tell the story? I sometimes come across fantastic stories, and then I FOIA the CIA, and they say, yeah, we're not going to release you anything. And so I have to live another 50 years to get those classified documents released. And so you need the documents. So like in the case of the wager, I found this plethora of documents. Just to go back, as a weird way a story can begin, I just want to mention Killers of the Flower Moon, because sometimes it can even begin with a photograph. I went to the Osage Nation, and when I was visiting the museum, I saw this great panoramic photograph on the wall, and it showed members of the Osage Nation. It was taken in 1924, standing alongside white settlers, and it looked very innocent. And I asked the museum director, Catherine Redcorn, who's since become a very good friend of mine, but back then I was meeting for the first time, and I said, I noticed a part of the photograph that was missing. It had been cut out. And I said, why is that part of the photograph missing? And she said, well, it contained a figure that was so frightening, we decided to remove it. And she then pointed to the missing panel, and she said, the devil was standing right there. And that was the seeds that set me off on a 5-year journey to understand that who that evil figure was and embodied. And so they can begin in all sorts of ways. Then you need to find the materials. That's always a challenge. And so you spend many, many months before you commit to a story, just gathering, getting documents. And then there has to be a third level. There has to be this gripping story. Like, the wager is crazy. If you read the wager, it's just like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, what more could go wrong? Oh, that's going to go wrong, you know? And people just do crazy, fat, mad stuff, I won't swear. But it also, to me, raised all these really interesting themes, these deeper themes that had these dimensions that resonated today. It was more than just a gripping story. It was a story that really told us something about human nature, something about civilization, something about imperialism, something really profound about the nature of truth, and something I think profound about the way we tell history and shape history and often manipulate it. Killers of the Flower Moon obviously pointed to these systemic injustices, these deep prejudices, the rendering of a people so that they were killed because they weren't seen as fully embodied souls. I mean, they were killed, those Osage, for greed, but they were killed wantonly and systematically because the perpetrators didn't treat them as human beings. And you see that play out again with this encounter with the Karaskwar and the white and the castaways. And even the Lost City of Z, which was this adventure story. And at first when I began it, I was thinking about, oh, well, who was this explorer? And, you know, what happened to him, the mystery of what happened to him. But over time, the real deeper theme and what really interested me was the mystery of whether such a complex society could have existed, because so many anthropologists and modern archaeologists had assumed it couldn't exist in the jungle because there wasn't enough food and because only small familial groups, when people went in the 19th century and 20th century, they only found smaller groups. So they thought, well, and they were also colored by prejudice. They didn't think the indigenous people were capable of building a complex society. And so if such a place was discovered, it would shatter our understanding of what the Americas and the Amazon looked like before the arrival of Columbus. So again, that's that third dimension. So that's the analytical process, but I will confess that there is complete instinctual unconscious process where you're just like, this is a story. It gets under me. I can't let it go. 3 weeks later, I'm still thinking about it. I still want to read about it. I want to spend time with it. And that's the kind of unconscious, irrational, obsessive part that gets hold of you, and you end up on these quests and you go to Wager Island or hunt through the Amazon or do something stupid.
Well, given the amount of effort and actual years of research that you get involved in to write your books, does it ever scare you that one may not be a commercial success and you've just spent 5 years researching something that no one's interested in?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and also, yeah. Part of the expedition.
We have to leave some surprises for you. But yes, you are always filled with doubts. You know, you are always, doubts gnaw you. And, you know, how many people read anymore, I hate to say. So you worry, is this the right story? Did you pick the right one? Will it strike a chord? And you never know. But at some level, you just have to believe in the story. And I remember when I finished Killers of the Flower Moon, at that time, like, there were not a lot of expectations that book would sell, that people really want to read about this kind of story. And I remember my lovely wife, Kira, you know, she said, well, whatever, you know, you wrote an important book, and you should be proud of it. And at some level, you have to take comfort in that, and you have to believe enough in the story, and that will get you through. But you do always have doubts, and you will find out what happened to the Spanish galleon, I promise. Thank you all so much. I think I'm going to sign some books or something.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.